We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by my old buddy, Quint Kesnick. Quint, we should leak this podcast. Just post it early. What do you think?
Foy, I got to tell you, it was a little deflating yesterday to drive from Ithaca, New York, 4.5 hours, car gripping the wheel like this, to get to the studio to do the selection show with the drama, the intrigue, the suspense. And then it gets blown up in our face. So it was a little deflating, to say the least, the way yesterday shook down.
Well, sorry for the deflation, but you are a spin it forward person, which is something that I very much respect about how you approach everything in life. Yeah. We cannot understand the future without understanding the past. I'm a history major in college. So the compromise is we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what was, and then we're going to spend more time talking about what will be. You, as you just mentioned, had the opportunity to spend the weekend in Ithaca, New York, where you saw the Princeton Tigers emerge as very clearly the best team in college lacrosse, both resume and on-field product-wise. You have been proclaiming that, putting them at the top of your poll for about the last month or so. Congratulations on being very smart. What do you take away from the Tigers?
I thought they looked good. I thought that was a peak effort on Sunday, and they will regress off that game. I guarantee it. Lucky for them, they play Marist or Stony Brook. And so even if they play poorly, they should be able to win that game. Other than Notre Dame, you can't say that about anyone else in the bracket. If you don't play well, you don't advance. The number one and two seeds are kind of given that leeway. In terms of Princeton, more of a complete team than I think I thought early on in the season. I thought they maybe were just an offensive team with an okay defense. They'd been overly reliant on Ryan Craddock last season, had some question marks. You know, Molshine and Bath both graduated, didn't know what the close defense looked like, heard that, Jack Stahl was a real player from early games, and then all of a sudden Finn Fox is covering people at X like he's very capable. And then the off-ball defense, I had written on my board, you know, ball watchers. They tend to be ball watchers inside. And the other day when the ball was behind, when Cornell had the ball behind, their heads were on a swivel. They did a really nice job covering up inside. And Cornell doesn't really have a great outside bomber in terms of stretching a defense. The second thing is shorties. Jackson Green's really good. Cooper Miller's really good. They were, with the cooler weather, they were able to protect their shorties 3 and 4. I'm not sure that's going to be the case throughout this tournament, and I think that's an area of vulnerability. Their clearing can be a little shoddy at times. It was good during the Ivy League weekend. I look forward to seeing how that progresses down the road when maybe they could see some 10-man rides. And then the offense. You know, offense is deep. Love the second midfield. Tucker Wade, to me, is one of the best offensive midfielders in the country. Top five, easy, maybe top three, maybe top two, maybe the best at getting to the net and putting his shots in really good areas. And then the attack, you know, Colin Burns, they put a shorty on him. And I just liked the way he handled that. You know, he didn't press to the net too much. He set a lot of picks. He changed some matchups. I thought he was really smart. I thought Nate Kibiri was a little quiet, but that was fine. He played within the scheme, and Princeton got over the hump. 7 straight losses to Cornell. They get over the hump, and that's a nice hurdle for them to clear before this tournament.
I thought you started in the right place, which was, while I was watching this game, I was just like, they are putting so much into this, emotional energy-wise, that it's going to be really hard for them to bounce back. And interestingly, the place my mind went was 2022, when Princeton hosted BU, and I felt like BU failed to respond to the amount of emotional energy they exerted in winning their first Patriot League tournament. And your point is well taken, that the playing game gives them an opportunity to – or not the playing game themselves, playing the winner of a game of a team that had played a game, you know, 3 days prior, is going to go a long way toward, you know, balancing out some of those energy reserves. I also, your hesitancy about their ability to play complementary lacrosse is one of the things that has emerged for me. And it was really more than at the defensive end. It's Andrew McMeekin. I thought that at the beginning of the season, the first half of the season, really, there were some mediocre to poor performances from both McMeekin and Kraddick that were kind of overlooked because they had played well in other big games. And those seem to have smoothed out. We haven't seen pitfalls in either of their performances since then. And obviously, McMeekin had a highlight moment with his BTB goal in that one that I think is going to live in memory for some time. My mind goes toward the preseason when I felt like there was a tier of three teams, Maryland, Princeton, and Syracuse, that sat above what I felt like was the fourth team, North Carolina, for a variety of reasons, but the leading reason was their returning veteran offense. And I think that that's a good entry point into talking about what we saw in Selection Sunday more broadly, because Princeton loses their first game to Penn State, and I think it's reasonable to be like, okay, well, you know, this idea of a tier of three is incorrect. And how is it going to manifest its incorrectness? And then through the lens of looking back at the end of the regular season, we have one of those three teams sitting atop the field. We have another very much in the middle of the field in Syracuse. And then we have a third that was the first team out of the NCAA tournament in Maryland. Ed Lee from the Baltimore Sun texted me to ask if I remembered a team that was a preseason number one that missed the NCAA tournament. He said he had researched it back to 2001 and couldn't find one. And it just demonstrates the dichotomy or trichotomy of these potential outcomes. How do you think about that with respect to your season-long view of how those three teams have evolved?
I think people may have put too much stock in that season-opening loss to Penn State.
No question.
Because if you look at this entire field, two games stand out to me. Penn State beating Princeton on opening day when they jumped up with 7-1. And then Army losing at Lafayette. Mm. Army losing to Lafayette corresponding to the war in the Middle East breaking out that week, by the way, also. And so you put a lot into that, and maybe our judgments, and then Army would actually lose three in a row, I believe. But I think that clouds your judgment, because every time I turn on the tape, I loved what I saw from Princeton, especially on the offensive side of the ball. And they got off to a bad start. The Ivy League starts late. I think Penn State had a game under their belt. I'm almost positive they did.
I think that that was their third game. They had two games under their belt.
Yeah, that was their third game against Princeton's first game, and they fall behind early and couldn't win a face-off. And like, so again, that's a mulligan. I like what I'm seeing from Princeton. John Dumphy's turned out to be a really major threat. The freshman Mitty is super fast, and they just got options on offense, and Jimmy Mitchell does a good job. He makes adjustments. You know, if teams are slow to slide, he puts guys in clear ISO situations. They'll change whether they're attacking from up top, wing, or behind. I think he's got some good answers there. So I kind of struggle to see them going into a prolonged scoring streak, slump, that is, because of both personnel and coaching.
So where do you want to go next? We can talk about Syracuse and Maryland. We can talk about Cornell and Yale, the other two teams that you saw this weekend.
We'll go to Cornell, because I thought Cornell was great on Friday night. I mean, Cornell, that was a great game they played on Friday night. They were dialed in. Their transition game was cooking. They were pushing it. It was really noticeable that they wanted to go, whether it was 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, or they had numbers. They weren't involved with a sub game. It was really attacking before the defense was set. You know, and then Goldstein and Firth are kind of known commodities. The other guys, again, it's hard to trust them. I think there's something there. I didn't see as much cutting and successful off-ball play against Princeton that I saw in the Ivy League semifinals. You got to play off of Goldstein. You got to play off of Firth.
The thing that was interesting to me about that one was, again, going back to the emotional energy, particularly what Goldstein brought, the sequence where he got flagged for the unsportsmanlike, and it was either the second or third contact that he had made with a Princeton player on the ride. And I guess, so I come at this from two angles. The first is, it's hard to defend a championship. And the second, or kind of adjacent part of that, is it's particularly hard when you have to withstand the number of, I mean, the graduation losses or whatever, right? Like, and that for me was why Cornell was number five in the preseason.
82 goals from one guy. Hugh Kelleher's drawn double teams in every possession. So,
well,
I get this group.
I'm not going to stand for the Michael Long erasure either.
Yeah, no, he wasn't great last year, but still, he is what he is. This team is the version that we saw Friday in the semifinals was kind of maximized. Although I do think Rowan Nury and AJ Nicklick still have more upside. There's more there. They're going to get healthy. They'll actually get better next week. It's a defense. This is a defensive team. Let's not make this, you know, you got Dooley, Marshall, and Brendan Staub. Michael Marshall was the best player on the field in the semifinals. Brendan Staub may have been the best Cornell player in the loss to Princeton. He was everywhere. He was making plays. I was really impressed. And then you got Cascadin, so you win a faceoff, so it's strong up the middle, and that's a good formula.
To the injury point, Cascadin's absence in the middle of the season, in addition to obviously Nicklick, who was gone for a longer stretch of time, and Nury, who was gone for kind of in between those two guys, yeah, it's really significant. But the point that you made about this is a defensive-oriented team, how much of that do you attribute to the solidness or steadiness in goalie play coming out of Matt Tully?
I do, but I think it's a lack of – they realize they're not going to get to 12, 13, 14 goals against teams. And so they got to win by getting to 10, 11, or 12, and they need transition because their 6-on-6 is not that great when teams can cover Goldstein and Firth. You don't have other Dodgers who can draw double teams. You don't have a stretch shooter. Your shorties aren't really gifted in transition, Lamb and Gilmartin, but your poles kind of are. You're close defenders, believe it or not, Staub and Marshall. So how are you going to get to 12 goals or 11 goals or 10 goals? And they put together a string of five games in a row where they held teams to single digits. I think that's the formula. I think Connor, saw the light. And like every team's path to victory is different based on their identity. And I think this team has a defensive identity.
Let's round out this conversation by talking about Yale, who was the last team into the NCAA tournament, losers to Princeton on Friday night, and then Harvard, who was probably the second team out, with Maryland being the first team out, losers to Cornell, as you mentioned. What did you see out of the Bulldogs and the Crimson?
I was more impressed. I hadn't watched a second of Yale prior to last week, and I plugged in the tape and got to see some of their games, and especially focused on the six consecutive wins. The Cornell win, Albany, they drowned, obviously Brown, Harvard, Hofstra. And, you know, in person, I thought they were faster than they looked on tape. Peter Moynihan, the midfielder, can really run. Dylan Blakicki is fast and explosive. Connor Gately is smooth. He's fast. He can create separation at X. So their team speed, the youth on offense is just amazing how young they are. And then the veteran D, they're just so much buttoned. They're more buttoned up. They have better stances. Their spacing is better. They're doubling concepts. This is a defense 2 years ago. They would fall over themselves. They were. I sent you video. They were the Keystone Cops of defense. Bad slides, creating offense. Two guys in one gap, so to speak, if you're talking football. And this year, they're really organized. I give Noah Fosner a ton of credit for the work he's done with this defense.
And how about Harvard?
Harvard's toast. Harvard, it's as simple as they lost their best defensive player, Yost DeKoning. They lost their faceoff man, Umansky. And their best offensive player, Jack Spiedel, is hurt. So the version of Harvard in February and March is playoff worthy and a dangerous team. The version of Harvard that exists today at the end of the year is not. And so I don't feel bad that they didn't make the playoffs, because I don't think they're putting a great product out there right now because of those injuries.
So you're interested in spinning this forward. We don't know how to talk about Princeton's opponent because we don't know who they are. Cornell hosting Johns Hopkins, Yale heading to Syracuse.
I got one question for Stony Brook. I watched part of the Mariana game. That game was lit. It was exciting. It was
incredible.
Up and down.
Yeah.
I was very surprised that Stony Brook beat Towson. The whole weekend, that was probably the most surprising result. Did it shock you as much?
I mean, yes, it was the – I don't want to call it – yeah, I mean, it was the biggest upset of the weekend. 17 saves is always going to be a factor, and not only that, but also I feel like if you're an underdog in that scenario, you have to get out to the big lead and hang on, and that's exactly what happened. And they got that one goal that stemmed the Michael Weishar on rush and turned it into what was what had been cut to a two-goal margin into a three-goal lead, and then they were able to ride the wave from there. So in game flow, it wasn't surprising, because we've seen that when upsets happen, they tend to happen this way. But if you were to ask from a before the season or before the game, you know, before the day, before the weekend starts standpoint, like, yeah, it was definitely the biggest surprise.
Yeah, that surprised me.
I'm particularly interested in both of these Cornell Hopkins and Yale Syracuse matchups.
Well, those are games I'm doing on TV with Anish.
Then perfect. Here we go.
I'm going back to Ithaca. Going back, I'm a regular in the Ithaca Commons.
A matchup that is about as historic as it gets in the sport of lacrosse, and yet hasn't been played really at all
since
over the course.
Since I played in the last time,
right?
Hopkins played Cornell. That is just when Anish told me that yesterday. I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, because I think about these teams in the 90s and then the 2000s, they had similar profiles, and you think they would meet somewhere along the line, and they didn't. And, you know, they traded coaches with Coach Petromala and Coach Milliman. They got a lot of history. But this is the first meeting in, 35 years or whatever it is. That's nuts.
Which I assume is a function of, you know, Dave Petromala getting hired by Richie Moran, not wanting to play him. Jeff Tamburoni getting hired by Dave Petromala, not wanting to play him. Like the shared DNA between the two programs oftentimes means that, hey, let's scrimmage, but let's not play a game that actually has stakes. And now, you know, that has continued with Pete Milliman taking on Connor Busick, a guy that, you know, he didn't hire him, but he was on staff when he got hired, and certainly was on staff with him, retained him as an assistant when he took over as head coach.
Yeah, this is a tough spot for Hopkins. Cornell's got to bounce back, okay? So they were the bully over Princeton for all these 7 years. They got punched in the face last week. Sometimes when you knock the bully down, he doesn't get up the same way that he used to be. So I worry, you know, Cornell's got to find themselves. Hopkins limps into this game in a season, really an awful performance in the Big Ten championship game. Quentin Kilrain, his status. There's three injuries this weekend are huge. Hunter Aquino of Penn State, Owen Duffy of North Carolina, Quentin Kilrain of Johns Hopkins. Those are three really gigantic injuries. And Kilrain's probably, I would rate, is the number one injury of the week, because if he doesn't play, who the heck is going to cover Ryan Goldstein and Willem Firth?
Carson Brown is going to cover one of them. And I think what we saw against Penn State was, you know, hopefully Luke Martin can get back to health. But either way, it's less about who's going to match up on the other one. It's more about, are they going to be able to be as buttoned up interior as they need to be? Because what I saw out of that Penn State Hopkins game was Liam Matthews early on exploiting the space that he was able to find inside, and that creating interior gravity that sucked in the Hopkins defense, and that gave the rest of Penn State's offense a lot of space on the outside. And to your point about how that matches up against Cornell, a team that doesn't have a ton of bombers, on the one hand, you're not able to exploit it, right? Because you don't have somebody that can step down from 13 or 14 yards and take advantage of the additional space. But on the other hand, that means that you're going to have guys flying out at you, and you're going to be able to dodge off the approach. And so it really, in my opinion, comes down to, can Cornell's offense get Hopkins' defense spinning? And I think that's where having a air traffic controller, Kilrain, then you're in trouble.
Kilrain is two things. He's probably their best cover guy on ball, and he's their most organizing defender. He's their voice of the defense.
I think Carson Brown is their best cover guy on ball.
Carson Brown, this is a new league for him, covering a guy like Firth and Goldstein. That doesn't exist in the Big Ten this year, really. That heady type of player like that. The body type's a little smaller for Carson. He's going to have to get down low. So I don't know which guy he'll cover, but if you're double-teaming Goldstein, you got problems, because his vision is sensational. I thought Finn Fox being able to put him on an island was just magnificent for Princeton.
Shifting to the other matchup that you have, the reason I'm so interested in Yale versus Syracuse is because they represent two very different ends of the spectrum. You're not going to find many teams that are older than Syracuse,
older
and you're
and
not
going
to find many teams that are younger than Yale. Yeah.
Yeah, oldest and youngest. They played, 2017 when Ben Reeves was a junior. They had a playoff game up there. It was a good game. It's a one-goal game. So Yale comes back. And to me, a lot of this depends on their youth. And I mean, they start two freshmen and a sophomore on attack. Their goalie's a sophomore. Their defense is very veteran. Their midfielders are kind of like in the middle, sophomores and juniors. Yale's going to have a really good team next year. There's a lot of really good teams next year. So that's a problem with being good next year. Join the club. But if the Dome mystique gets to them, you know, survive the first 8 minutes, let's say, because Georgetown went up this year with high hopes. And next thing you know, that game spiraled out of control. And if you look at Syracuse's performance line, there's a major difference between how they play at home and how they play on the road. There's just a major difference. Just look at the numbers. They have been awful on grass. They've been awful on the road. In the dome, they crush people.
Was there anything in particular that you took from that ACC semifinal loss that you think is going to linger? Or, because I put myself in the mindset of last season where a lot of Syracuse fans were jumping off the boat heading into the ACC tournament. And, you know, I took the opposite approach, which was I think they can win the ACC tournament. And I think that they can get to the Final Four. And that's what happened. And this year I was on Syracuse radio last week and I said the opposite, which is that, like, I don't get the sense that this team feels like it has a ton to play for. Like, they know they're in the NCAA tournament with respect to their trip to Charlotte. They know they're in the NCAA tournament, and they know that they have one goal, one standard by which they're going to be evaluated, and it is not winning an ACC championship. So, you know, I kind of came away from that semifinal feeling a little cold. Like, it was – there. I was like – It reminded
me of the end of the world, right?
Notre Dame in the late 2010s, where it was just like they treated the ACC tournament like a chore, like it was something they needed to get over.
So Notre Dame basically threw their game, by the way, and did not pay any kind of price for it. They got an extra day's rest or two. They go home with a chip now. The players are angry. I mean, Corrigan manufactured that weekend to perfection. If you're Notre Dame, what a great move. And you moved out to the two in the seed line. Who really cares? I think the theme for Syracuse, though, is can they beat a top-tier team? Look at their record against top-five teams. It's not great. And, you know, game management, the details, you know, offsides calls, penalties at crucial times, poor defense at crucial times, pick defense. Like, look, there's a lot of good things about the Syracuse team. They need to start playing like seniors. They need to start making decisions like seniors because that's going to be their advantage in this tournament. Okay, this is the last run for them. They've got to play with that desperation, but a dialed-in desperation. You know what I mean? They got to be the smarter team. With all the experience these guys have, Joey Spallina, Finn Thompson, Michael Leo, Riley Figueres is a junior, Billy Dwan, Jimmy McCool's played a zillion games. Use your experience to win the critical moments in a playoff game. Like they have to do that now, and so that's got to be a little bit of a switch, I think.
So it kind of sounds like you feel like they're pretty considerable favorites at home against Yale for the reasons that you just laid out. How surprised would you be if Yale were to pull off the upset?
I would be surprised.
Okay.
I mean, who's gone up to the dome in the last year
Harvard.
Or two?
Harvard.
And had huge success.
Yeah. Harvard twice last year, and they were veteran, right? And I think that you know, I think my reaction is that if Yale's able to do it, it just shows that this project is much farther along than anybody outside of that locker room would assume.
Yeah, Yale's team speed I thought was outstanding. Their organization on defense, they have Patrick Pisano, who can cover Spallina. I thought their midfield defense was good. The faceoffs are okay. Nick Wehmeyer is okay. Ben Friedman's got it. You know, this is the first time in the dome for him. We'll see how that goes. I think that Figueres will cover Connor Gately. Blakicki, you know, with his speed, could give Syracuse some issues in terms of who's on him.
Yeah, I'm going to have my eyes on Sean Grogan in this one. Where do you want to go next?
Wherever. Where are we going next?
Why don't we talk about the bracket?
I'm going to probably drive home. It's my second week in a row in Ithaca. It's crazy. What are the odds of that? I don't go up there for like 30 years, and now I'm there every year and every weekend.
You love it. You've got a place in what?
It's a great town, by the way. Do you know there's like no franchises in Ithaca? It's all mom and pop. It's, you know, it's like old America. I love it.
Let's go to the bracket, and I think it's the lens through which we can talk about Richmond and North Carolina, because and Duke for that matter. The way I interpreted the conversation on the selection show was that your biggest point of contention was Duke's inclusion. My biggest point of contention was I felt like Richmond had pretty clearly secured a 3 seed over North Carolina, and they get rewarded by hosting Duke. Give us your thoughts on the way the criteria was implemented.
I don't look at they get hosed by having to play Duke. I just like Duke gets in the tournament. I think Duke's a really good team. I've covered them a lot this year. I think I covered them 3 straight weeks. They're a good team. They had the lead in all their losses. They you know, they're a couple plays away from being nearly undefeated. But also, you have to question that non-conference schedule. And does that send a message does that change the way coaches are going to schedule going forward? And I would hate to say, yeah, it's going to decrease the amount of top tier, you know, conference to conference matchups that we see. Second thing is that
we move off that point. So I asked Matt Colagiovanni, the chair, whether or not he or the committee feels like it's their responsibility to.
It's not.
Should it
but
be?
But their interpretation of their, because if you plug Maryland into Duke's schedule, you get the exact same record. Maryland beat Virginia, but then Maryland finishes with the exact same record that Duke has right now. If you plug this Maryland team into Duke's schedule, okay, Maryland's not losing to any of the games that Duke went 8-0 in, and that's a fact, Jack. Duke benefited,
but that's not what
from
happened.
Not playing in the ACC tournament.
Because that is
Maryland
true.
Played in their league tournament and took a loss. Harvard played in their league tournament and took a loss. Duke didn't qualify for their tournament and sat out and actually passed those two teams.
They were already ahead of them, and they weren't passed. Those two teams had the opportunity
to pass
them.
But if they were in the tournament and they lose a game, how's it look? You know, again, you look at college football, and that's why they're going to get rid of some of these conference championship games. They got to figure that out. I know it's a huge money haul, but people aren't happy with playing in a college – In a league championship game prior to the college football playoff, and that pulling you down in terms of your seed.
So,
does that make sense, Terry?
It does. I do think. Okay, so here's my general reaction to the seeding, and it doesn't necessarily relate to the selection, but so my interpretation is that the committee looked at who were the unseeded teams and then how were they going to be able to accommodate the geographic restrictions as well as the conference restrictions, meaning that you couldn't send Duke to Carolina or Virginia. So you basically had two options. You could send them to Richmond or you could send them to Hopkins. And
yes.
Otherwise you had to utilize a flight, in which case where were you taking the flight away from somebody else? And what my assessment, and I think what the committee's assessment was, is that it would not there was not a northern team that justified a three seed that you could send Albany to. And so as a result, you had to use the flight for Albany, and then you didn't have an additional flight because you had to send somebody to Notre Dame. All of that, the way that nets out for me, is that's why Richmond is 4 and not 3, because you can't justify sending Duke to the 3 seed, but you can't send him to Carolina. So as a result, you make Richmond the 4 seed, and then so on and so forth. It works out that way with can you send Georgetown to the 8 seed and have them jump the teams that were clustered around 9, 10, 11? No. So then you make Virginia the 5 seed, and then you can justify sending Georgetown to Virginia.
There's no easy games here. The Georgetown, remember, went to Duke last year and won a road game. Richmond went to North Carolina last year and won a road game. So, like, I have respect for everybody in this round. If you don't show up ready to play, it's not like the old days. There's only two gimmies, and that's up top and down at the bottom of the bracket.
So let's talk a little bit more about Duke versus Richmond. You know, the Spiders are one of the stories of the season, a lone loss on April 4th to Notre Dame at Northwestern, and coming off of a program high water mark, winning a game at North Carolina in the first round last year before losing to Cornell in the quarterfinals, giving the Big Red their stiffest test in the postseason. For me, this is the game of the first round. If I were able to teleport myself to any single one, the idea of being in Robins Stadium for a night game against the Blue Devils is the most appealing. I think that crowd is going to be electric. What's your take on this game?
Drew Carter and and Kark will be there covering that game. They're also doing the Georgetown-Virginia game, so that's their double up, and we're up in Central New York. I think that Richmond is being a little bit overlooked and disrespected right now at 14-1. I really do. They haven't been crushing teams in the conference towards the end of the season, and maybe that's some of it, but the parallels to Loyola are really strong because people didn't respect that Loyola Greyhound team back in, 2012?
Yep.
When they won the national championship, they had that late season loss. Yeah, they're good, but they're not great. Well, I think Richmond's really good. I do. And I think people, they beat Virginia already. Last year they played Duke. It was an overtime game. Aiden McGuire scored to win it. I think Richmond is better than they were last year by a significant margin. I don't see them with any noticeable weaknesses. They're not awesome in any department, but they're pretty darn good in every department.
And what about Duke?
And that's their strength.
What are Duke's weaknesses?
Attack play. The ball's just never behind the goal with any kind of success. They don't have a quarterback of the offense. You know, your two guns are, you know, Max Sloat and Ben Johnston. They're in front of the goal type players. Really athletic defense. You know, the shorties after McGuire are average. The faceoff game has been average. The goaltending has been hit or miss. And then the ability to finish games, their numbers in the second half, because they don't have a second midfield. It's a dreadful second midfield. They run out of gas. So if you're Richmond, you want a hot day here because Duke is not particularly deep. Look at their shooting percentage in the second half of the games. Look at their goals against in critical games. And don't look at the first eight games of the season. Take their stats from after they were 8-0 and evaluate those properly, because Duke's numbers are just inflated like Jose Canseco because of those first eight games.
There are two games that we haven't really gone into detail on, and they feature the ACC champion and the Big Ten champion. Penn State hosting Army Saturday, 2:30. Virginia hosting Georgetown Sunday, 7:30, like you mentioned. Let's start in State College. We talked a little bit about Penn State's win over Hopkins, but what are your thoughts on welcoming the Black Knights to Happy Valley?
Those two teams played in a quarterfinal game in, what, 2023?
Yes.
When Army beat Maryland.
Yep.
And then they nearly had a comeback to beat Penn State.
When these seniors were freshmen.
Yeah. To keep the change year. Army's got talent. I'm really impressed with the way they finished the season, because they had that midseason slump, as I mentioned.
And three straight losses to Lafayette, BU, and North Carolina.
And Carolina, close. And they got good players. Army's got named players. Hill and Evan Plunkett. They got John O'Sullivan, the heavyweight champ defender. You know, Sean Byrne, one of the top goalies in the country, and they're playing well. So that's a great game. That is a great game, because Penn State, to me, both these teams are really kind of at a crescendo. Penn State finished the season with a flourish. They had Andrew Beard healthy, and I think that's made the difference for their offense. Hunter Aquino's health is really important in that game. And then the goaltending matchup really kind of favors Army if you look at the numbers. So I don't have a strong feeling in that game.
I talked to Joe Alberici last night, and his comment with respect to both the disappointment of having missed the NCAA tournament each of the last two seasons and having lost to Penn State in the quarterfinals when these seniors were freshmen was the same, which is, it doesn't do us any good. It's not what we can use. We can learn from it, but we can't utilize it. So very much a forward-looking perspective. I always kind of question the veracity there. I think it's human nature to say, you know, these guys ended our season 2 years or 3 years ago, and we have an opportunity for revenge, and let's utilize that as fuel. I'm a big believer in that notion. But I think you're right in the way that it's so impressive how much talent Army, or how much star power Army graduated last year, and how many stars they still have on this roster. And you mentioned a bunch of them, but in addition to that, we've got Braden Fountain and Aiden Weisenborn and Keegan Tracy. And you know, last year it kind of felt like maybe Will Coletti was the skeleton key, much like Brady Wambach is for Carolina this year. And so the fact that they're 13-3, where they were 10-2 last year, is, in my opinion, even more impressive, because they haven't had that benefit of a completely tilted possession. They are just bigger, stronger, and more physical than so many of their opponents. And that's why I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they match up with this Penn State squad, where in the middle of the field, they have a lot of meat themselves.
All these games, like Army-Penn State, knowing both coaches, that's going to be an incredible game. It really is.
One of the things that's cool about that is they scrimmage like every year. So they are familiar with each other personnel-wise. But the thing about a scrimmage that's so interesting is you don't scout it, right? And you watch the film after, but you usually only watch it for yourself. You're not really diagnosing your opponent. And so it's got to be like an interesting mindset shift where you go from, yeah, we've got a certain measure of familiarity with this group, but at the same time, it's not that useful. I think that's, from a tactic and preparation standpoint, a really interesting paradigm.
And then let's say Penn State wins, which I'm not saying they would, but to face Princeton then in that next round is probably the opponent that Princeton would like to face.
Because of the motivation of revenge?
They lost that game. That's an easy get-up-for game. But, like my dream is to have Army march to championship weekend one of these years on Memorial Day weekend. That would be epic. So my daughter still wears the Keep the Change t-shirt. It's her favorite t-shirt.
Virginia Georgetown, the Cavaliers are probably, they have the second claim behind Princeton for hottest team in the country. And North Carolina did not pose much of a test for them in the ACC championship game on Sunday. It was make it, take it. It was Harlem Globetrotters. It was we've got too many highlights that we can't fit into this game recap. I mean, just an incredibly impressive showing. You know, Truett Sunderland, Brendan Millen, McCabe Millen, Hudson Hausman, Jake Merrick made
saves. Did Robbie Hopper play? I haven't tuned it in. Was Hopper back in the lineup?
I believe so. That's a good question. I had it on my second screen. I don't know.
Because I had their Drexel game. That right. Team is playing so loose. They're having so much fun on offense now.
They're playing so much like Virginia.
What they lack in a second midfield, they make up for in the transition game, the early offense, the you know, 5-on-5 sub game they like to do. Jake Merrick continues to just pull these saves out of his, you know, I don't know how he does it. To me, he's living a charmed life in some of these games. Georgetown did this last year. They went to Duke and they dictated the terms of engagement. I think Georgetown's dangerous in this game because they can get the ball behind the net to Liam Connor. And Virginia's defense is at its worst when the ball is behind the net. You get those guys to turn their heads. They don't want to play off ball. When you attack Virginia top down, it's much like Notre Dame. They're going to eat that stuff up. You got to swing the ball behind the net, and that's what Georgetown does. So I expect Georgetown to score.
Hopper finished with 3 ground balls and a caused turnover in that one. Aiden Murnane also had a highlight ground ball in his own zone.
Hopper is a polarizing player for me because he is as talented a player at that position that I have ever seen. His feet, his hands, his ability to scoop the ball, his ability to throw crossfield passes on a dime from different – he's a magical player. But he's also a major defensive liability, especially when he gets tired. He'll take plays off. He'll give up 2 or 3 goals a game. And, man, if he could discipline himself, if he can get in elite shape, he can be one of the greatest to play that position. Michael Earhart, Steve Mitchell, Joel White-type player. That's how good I think he could be. He's very close. He's just kind of got to grow up, stop chasing the flash plays because, man, he is so talented.
All right. I think we have digested championship weekend and look forward to the NCAA tournament in a relatively succinct and satisfactory way. You want to finish up with you got a couple
Jacksonville.
Season.
We got to congratulate Jacksonville, don't we?
Sure.
Jacksonville played the hard schedule, and I think it paid off for them. And I have a ton of respect for them. Romo comes in, winners of 13 straight. It's a team I saw in week one against Johns Hopkins. Nate Fechter, the rejector, is a great goalie. So I think those teams deserve some love. And then there's Albany. Well, Scotty Marr just wins his league.
Before we move off of that, I mean, you talk about Stony Brook beating Towson as the upset of the weekend. Robert Morris, LIU, that finish, and those things happened in like a half-hour window.
Seconds.
Well, no, I'm talking about the end of the Stony Brook-Towson game led directly into the end of the Robert Morris-LIU game. And that was over the course of the weekend. And, you know, I have touted the Thursday of conference championship week is the best week of the calendar because the start times are staggered, the stakes are insanely high, and you tend to get a lot of drama compacted in ways that feel like March Madness. And I don't want to say I was underwhelmed, but it wasn't the best Thursday we've ever had. That half-hour window that went from Stony Brook to the Robert Morris LIU finish is what you dream about. If we were to ever have a 64-team men's lacrosse tournament with 16 games on Thursday and 16 games on Friday.
And think about if we staggered every weekend the way we stagger championship week. If we played 2 games on Thursday night, if we played Friday 2 games, if the Saturday schedule was a 12, 2, 4, 6, and 8, with maybe Utah playing at 10 p.m., if Sunday had 3 games, a 1, 3, and 5, like the sport would be in a better place. It really would be. We'd be getting more eyeballs. It would crush it on social media. And more of these players would become household names. And more of these programs would get eyeballs. Again, that's another reason not everyone to play on Saturday at noon. And that's what I love about this week. You could watch every game. It's noon, 2:35, 7:30 each day on ESPNU. You can watch 8 games really easy. And they're in windows, Terry, of 2.5 hours. So barring weather, knock on wood, we'll go site to site.
I suppose we actually do have one more topic from the weekend that we got to discuss, which is the Terps. They were the first team out. It's the first time they've missed the NCAA tournament since 2002. A lot of conversation around the program. What are your thoughts?
Ed Lee's been blowing me up, so I did some research on it. Unofficially, I got their offense ending the year rated number 45 in the country.
Wow.
I got their defense ending the year rated number 45 in the country. I compared them to last year. The biggest difference I could see was in the goal. Logan McNaney was at 59%. Rupel's at 52%. That correlates to slightly less than two saves per game. If you give them two saves in three of their four losses, you could swing those games. So if Logan McNaney were in the game, there's two or less goal losses there. Maybe that swings it. A healthy Will Schaller, a healthy Eric Spanos. But the biggest thing I noticed when you look at their stat sheet, Higgins, Ford, Schultz, Aiken. Guys we thought were going to be like 20-point scorers this year. Way below their numbers. Stobaugh, strong first half of the season, really faded in the second half. So something was going on with that offense. It just never gelled. It never the salad didn't have the right ingredients.
So you mentioned earlier in the podcast that there are going to be a lot of really good teams last year. You mentioned a lot
next
of Maryland
year.
Next year. You mentioned a lot of Maryland underclassmen who underperformed. A lot of their upperclassmen who aren't going to be back were the ones that they relied on. What is the prognosis for this program?
As long as John Tillman's there, they're still going to be a top 10 program. I think Syracuse in the ACC, Syracuse will take a step back. They're senior laden. Duke returns everything. Virginia, we'll see if they can survive the transfer portal. Carolina is going to be loaded next year. So, Maryland is Maryland. It's a 1-year blip, but I think it's interesting to see like what's the why, what changed. Their shooting percentage is down just a hair. Their save percentage is down a lot. Is it one player? Is it a healthy Spanos? Is it a healthy Schaller? How come they didn't develop that second wave of players, guys that we thought were going to be stars, just didn't have years? You watch them play the last couple games of the season, and the offense is putrid. They can't get to the net. They fade around the goal. They're just running in circles around the net. It was not a good product at the end of the year.
Trying to take a 3-month view of this and think about February, March, and April, one of the things that comes to mind was all the weather disruptions early in the season. And you made a lot of Maryland, Richmond, and Georgetown Hopkins not getting rescheduled.
Yeah.
Who would have thought in early February that Maryland was going to be the one that suffered most out of those four teams?
John Tillman talked about the fall and injuries in the fall being really disruptive to their growth. And he felt like they had kind of a late start to spring because some of the personnel guys, they didn't play during the fall. Then, I covered their game when they went up to the Dome and lost by two. They played well. They played okay. And you said to yourself, wow, Syracuse is legit. And Maryland's going to be fine. They just need to get better. They never got better. Why do some teams like Yale take – Yale started, 3-4?
Because they were young.
6-7? Because they're young and they improve. You see other teams, Harvard, because of injuries, didn't surge. Virginia had that stretch. They were 3-4, and now they've improved. Again, Andy Shea, the race to improve. Lars Tiffany, the race to improve. And for whatever reason, Maryland did not improve this year.
Kind of moving along as far as the season goes, one of the other things that stands out, we had some really big crowds this year. And I think that that's something that should be celebrated and not forgotten, especially in the context of the negative storyline of how disruptive the early season weather was. So hopefully that persists heading into the first round of the NCAA tournament. It's always difficult to get big crowds because, A, short notice, right? The time and game is determined at most 6 days before when it gets played. And then, B, a lot of these campuses move out because school's out. But that just means that hopefully we get some local fans to support.
I mean, there's nothing like a big game in the Carrier Dome when they get near 10,000 fans, really educated fans. And that's such a great environment with the music, the PA, the lighting. There's nothing like Notre Dame, free admission, They're getting 5,000 fans right now, and that's becoming a spectacle. That's introducing lacrosse to people in that town that would have really no idea what is going on. But they get to go there, and they have money to eat hot dogs and drink sodas and have a great time with their kids running on the grassy knoll. And then Army-Navy. I mean, Army-Navy is a signature game, and that game is a special game. And I'm glad that it led the country in attendance, because it should. And I just wish more teams would place their games with an eye on attendance, with an eye on TV, with an eye on promotion and innovation, and quit playing on every Saturday at noon.
Well, I thought Duke at Carolina was a Saturday at noon game, and that was probably the best lacrosse crowd I've ever seen in Dorrance Field. So I think you're right to call those out, but you know, there are a couple of other impressive crowds that deserve to be shouted out, such as we talked about Richmond Notre Dame in Chicago. Once again, Notre Dame a consistent theme there. And then
Hopkins, Maryland got 7,500. Everyone's correct. Like, oh, 7,500. Like, that's a low for a Hopkins, Maryland game. That's a low threshold, believe it or not. That's how big that game. That game should be 10.
I'm interested in Georgetown and Virginia. Virginia's had some very good home crowds a Sunday night. Again, Mother's Day, it'll be interesting. But, you know, reasons for hope. So the last – you know, I know that this is not your favorite type of conversation, and so maybe it's not a great note to end on. But Patrick Stevens had an article in USA Lacrosse Magazine last week about the – development of the PowerWise, which is a prospective alternative selection criteria. We obviously, it's the day after Selection Sunday when we're talking, so never more attention paid to the subjective, objective criteria and how they were applied by now a seven-person committee. With another year's worth of evidence, where do you fall on this march toward the prospect of a wholly objective criteria or changed criteria with the implementation of NPI at Division III and Division I hockey? What are your thoughts on how we pick the tournament?
Yeah, hockey's talking about going to a 40-game schedule. I wish lacrosse would go to a 15-game regular season schedule plus conference tournaments. These kids need to play more games. If you're going to get them to campus on January 6th for the first day of practice, like, we got to be playing more games. But again, play more games with the good weather would really help the sport. You know, the selection conundrum is not unique to lacrosse. Hockey's had it. I see it in wrestling. You know, they have to seed 10 weight classes with 32 kids, basically 30 kids. There's 300 athletes, and there's, you know, I don't want to say mistakes, but there's controversy in every single bracket. And so I see a ton of brackets during the course of the season. Lacrosse is getting it right. I think it's getting better. I really do. I think it's gotten better. I don't have an issue. My issue with this year's committee was when we spoke to them, I didn't feel like I got smarter. I felt like maybe they were giving me answers that actually I found to be more circular, more incongruent, and more confusing than, you know, I felt like maybe one criteria for this decision, another criteria for this decision. And that's kind of how it's written out. You know, they have leeway.
It's objectively subjective.
They have leeway, and that's fine. And they're using the regional, regional committees, which are lacrosse people. And guys who really know the game. So that's a positive. So look, I got no beef with the committee. Yesterday in our calls with them, I was a little combative. So was Anish, because we just need to present. We just need to go on TV and present, like, how are your decisions made? Boom. You just give us your why you did this, and we're fine with it. There's no criticism of these decisions. And my only takeaway from this year going forward is going to be, do people dummy down their schedule a little and try to, job the RPI, so to speak, play a lot of lower teams from lower conferences who are going to go 11-3, because the way the RPI is written, that's a nice win for your RPI.
Make sure to check out InsideLacrosse.com later on Monday, because Patrick McEwen is going to have a piece advising against that strategy. Quint, anything else before we part ways?
It worked for Duke. It got them the high RPI, and then they had the one win over a top 10 team, and that was enough.
And yep. St. Joe's backed in. One other ACC team chooses to adopt that strategy, it's not going to work for either of them.
Why is that?
Because it has to be compounding. Duke benefited from the fact that the other four teams
They surfed in off the ACC RPI.
Correct.
Yeah, they drafted in.
Anything else?
That's it. Just excited for this week. You know, I got to go back up to Ithaca.
There you go.
A couple good restaurants in Ithaca, Foy. It's a good spot.
Enjoy. Drive safe.
Oh, go last quick. Thing.
Oh, go ahead.
So after, last thing. You there with me?
I'm there. I'm with you. I'm listening.
Okay. Princeton celebrating. Cornell comes into a huddle. Cornell demoralized. Princeton still celebrating. The Cornell guys, like five or six of them, have to run off to the end zone and shag the balls that were behind the net against the net. And one of them is Ryan Goldstein. He's just 5 minutes after the game. He's there cleaning the balls off the end line after a game like that, the Ivy League championship. And it just hit me as the most amazing, selfless team culture thing. Like,
sweep the sheds. Leave it better than you found it. Game on, 7:30 p.m.
Leave it better than you found it.
7 or 7:30 on Tuesday night?
7:30, I'm not sure.
Oh, what a terrible promo.
I did a story about Richmond with Dan Chiamatti. That's all I know. I had to voice it seven times. But yeah, I think you're going to like what you see in the show.
Quint, thanks for joining. You're the man.
Don't quit. Don't let him beat you.